Record and live on YouTube. So, all right, Jay Dyer is here from Esoteric Hollywood, Jay's Analysis. Jay, how are you?
Doing well, Charles. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm good. I can honestly say now that I have officially, I'm now a minion of the New World Order. As of this morning, I got the Mark of the Beast, the final second vaccine injection. So far, I feel okay, but... I'm not bringing this up to endorse it or condemn it. I'm simply mentioning it as a matter of personal choice. The environment I live in makes it necessary for me, I believe. But that's, you know, medical decisions are up to the individual, and I suggest people do their own research when they make those decisions.
Yeah, that I agree with. I agree that everybody should make their own decisions. Totally.
And do so with as much information as you can get, especially in this day and age of, frankly, of censorship. And, you know, you have to do a little extra digging to get to things. And, you know, this is a issue that's really fraught with controversy for me, and I think for everyone it should be. So you've been doing some amazing work. I mean, you've been doing amazing work for years. As Jay's Analysis and up on YouTube, you're one of the most knowledgeable people when it comes to issues of faith and where it intersects with politics. But you've been doing some pretty deep dives on the issue of satanic imagery in culture. And it seems to me that it's becoming, you know, your book, Esoteric Hollywood, gets into all of the various satanic imaging that's in various films, but it's the sort of thing that's kept a little bit under the hood, so to speak. I mean, most people, when they see that, they either think, oh, this is trendy or it's cute. You know, they don't really think that it's too much in your face, even though when you look at it and you come to understand it, you see that it is. But I think that now, in this year especially, maybe the pandemic, the Great Reset, whatever it is, it's no longer all that hidden. You know, I mean, it's right out there in the open. You know, we could talk about the halftime at the Super Bowl. We could talk about Nas X and his thing. One of the most satanic, you know, things I've seen come down the pike, and that's available at YouTube, and so a lot of other things. So, what do you say on that, Jay? Do you think that it's now something that's just out there and open, and if so, why?
I remember one of the. It's either Alice Bailey or Blavatsky has a book about how it would be an unveiling. Eventually, they wouldn't have to hide the attitude that they have of the esoteric. So I think we've entered into that aeon where they think it can all be in the open, and that's actually now that traditional religions have been weakened, it can now be open to the darker side. And so they actually do speak that way. I think there is something to that. I was just reading about Michael Aquino. I think he's a key figure to understand in this regard because, if people don't know, he eventually became the Army's head of psychological warfare. And he wrote a few books, actually went and read his books a couple of years ago. One of them was the document about mind war to psy war, which is how the Army would adopt a new approach to psychological warfare. And he even cites in that essay, it's the doctrine, the Army's doctrine of psychological warfare. And he says in there, the principles that you find in black magic and the satanic could be very relevant to targeting people or populations or the enemy in psychological operations. And what I think is interesting is that when you read that essay, he's actually not talking about some foreign enemy. He's talking about all of the domestic population, humans, anybody that's not kind of in that upper so-called elite or social Darwinian, more evolved structure. And that's, of course, why he found, I think, so many of the pagan philosophies, you know, the even the Nazi philosophies relevant to his worldview. And then what he did was he sort of co-opted a bunch of those, and then he created his own group after he sort of moved out of the Anton LaVey kind of more pop Satanism. He created a more serious satanic sect called Temple of Set. And I noticed too, many years ago, I read, I'll never be able to find where it was, but he had recruited different military, I don't know how high the military brass was, but he had recruited several military people into his cult. And then was, of course, under investigation at the Presidio for child abuse and all this kind of stuff. But he had even gotten people into the Club of Rome. There was one of the members of the Club of Rome. Of course, that's with Marie Strong and all these other characters who believe that, you know, the Earth needs to be radically depopulated. Most people need to be killed, all this kind of stuff. And in fact, he even had somebody at that highest level of the Club of Rome in terms of making, you know, global policy decisions about the environment and killing most people and all that. So in other words, even at that level, there were people that believe it's a kind of a satanic sacrifice. So what I think we're seeing is the usage on many different levels of the dark arts, dark sorcery, et cetera, for the power structure. And then in the power structure, some people believe it and some people don't. And the ones that don't just see it as a useful kind of tool for changing culture, turning people into more brutalized animal type people, you know, more bestial, making man more bestial, theater brutality, this kind of stuff. So I think that's what's going on with the infusion of that into pop culture. And I was just using Aquino as one of the key examples of that.
So we see what I think you're describing is an intersection between America's and I would argue the world's officially sanctioned secret societies, which are the things like the CIA and other agencies that actually we know are secretive because that's what their job is, and their use of satanic ritual, or I don't know if I'd go that far, but I'd say satanic principles, yep, as a means to study mind control, as a means of studying population control, world control. And, you know, it's not like they're all sitting around in some smoke-filled room. It's not like they all necessarily agree with each other. But they all have this same general trend. It continued to go further deep and broad even after the defeat of the Nazis, which, of course, they were totally into this. And MKUltra being an American program that actually officially was disbanded in the 1970s, but I think that even the church committee, which exposed it, acknowledged that elements of it would continue, except not necessarily officially. I mean, it would be, you know, pretty much off the books. And that the idea was to control the population through various means of manipulation, including actual, frankly, population control. Would you say that's what we're looking at?
Absolutely. I think that's the overriding plan. That's half of it. The other half is to then mutate and kind of try to steer evolution to move post-human, to go beyond the human. If you read The Philosophy of UNESCO by Julian Huxley, that's what he says.
Yes.
And he even includes all the points that you just made about, you know, basically killing most people off and he says all of that race hygiene that the Greeks did, that the Nazis and even the socialists, the other socialists all had a version of this too. He said all that, we'll just rebrand it. Just instead of calling it that, call it biometrics, call it population control, but it's all the same philosophy. And it's the idea that through science, we can tweak and mess with creation such that we can fix it, right? Because it's broken. So technology can be the great work that can fix this and make man perfect.
Right, right. Julian Huxley, he was the grandson of A.F. Huxley, who was Darwin's main promoter and who basically patented the idea of literally having debates with pastors and religious people to try to mock and minimize faith in God and faith in the Bible, which was a predominant view at the time. His brother was Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World and who tried to warn the world, actually, about what he called an international chemical concentration camp, as in the drugging of all people, and that he predicted that most people in the world would be taking some sort of controlled substance at some date. And that actually has turned out to be true.
Right.
And he committed suicide on the same day that using drugs, and he filmed it on the same day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. So it didn't get the kind of attention that it would have.
Wow.
His Julian Huxley founded UNESCO, which was supposed to be the World School Board. Yep. In 1947, and that, yeah, he wrote a book that talks about exactly what you're saying. He would take the idea of eugenics, which was a big progressive movement. Let's not forget, right, before World War II, you know, people like Margaret Sanger. I mean, yep, the main opponents to eugenics were the same people that oppose abortion today, the Catholic Church and conservatives. And he said, well, because of the bad stench of the Nazis and the Holocaust, we're going to rebrand it. Yep. And so, yeah, they gave it different names and they called it, he referred to evolutionary humanism, which, yep, basically put evolution on the scale of a religion. And that he wrote about that they would leave in place all the trappings of religions, you know, the rituals, the incense, the marriage ceremony, the burials. But they would take away the philosophy and the faith and replace it with evolutionary humanism, which, yes, is essentially worship of Darwin's idea that we are an evolving species and that there are superior members of that species, and that out of that superior group, after the weaker members fall by the wayside, will pop out this new species.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what, and you've talked about this, Jay, that is exactly what transhumanism is all about. Development of a new human species that is superior to who we are today, and that will be made up of this elect elite that you accurately note are studiers, at least of the principles, if not the practice of satanic ideas. Talk a bit, if you will, about, because I know you've been doing some work on transhumanism and what that is and where we can find out about it.
This, I think, again, also has its roots in the ancient world, probably in the pagan philosophies of the empires, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, and then kind of filtered more so specifically into the Greeks with their idea of techne. Now, I don't think that they thought necessarily that you could create a machine that would, you know, do all this stuff, but the basic principles of techne are in the Greeks, the basic ideas of perfecting of nature, this kind of stuff, and transcending nature. That's a very Hellenic idea, because for Plato and a lot of the Greek philosophers, the world is evil. It's a prison. It's trapped us here. It was created by some demiurge, some evil deity, this kind of stuff. So they have an anti-natural, anti-creation type of view. And so the goal is to get outside of this prison. If you were to watch a movie like 2001 by Kubrick, I think you kind of see the repeating of that same mindset, that we are stuck in this kind of limitations of spatiotemporal, you know, six dimensions, time and space are a prison. And at the end, you know, Bowman kind of like gets out of the limitations and becomes a god. He becomes Star Child. That's kind of repeating the idea. But in the modern world, I think when we get up into the French theorists like Saint-Just, Auguste Comte, Saint-Simon, these guys that were influenced by Weishaupt, influenced by Marx, influenced by, Marx comes later, but they're all in the school of socialism, of communism, of Marxism.
And they have, also, right?
Exactly, right. And they have this idea that you could say it's Promethean, basically the myth of Prometheus, that we could, you know, steal the fire of the gods. We can master the principles of technology to overcome the imperfections of nature. Bacon, of course, is very important in this. Bacon's New Organa, New Atlantis. Exactly. So there's a lot of different philosophers that kind of play into that in the time of, Enlightenment and all that. But, Rosicrucians are kind of overlooked, but they play an important role because they really start to focus on. This book, Rosicrucian Enlightenment, she actually posits that it was in fact the Rosicrucians that had a majority influence on the philosophy kind of in the background of the Enlightenment itself. And their idea was, and they had to have secret societies at that time because, well, we can't have it public. You know, this is too right. edgy. You know, everybody can't understand this. And the idea was through viewing man as kind of a chemical process himself. This is where basically alchemy eventually turns into supposedly chemistry, right? It's because the older ideas of alchemy are more tied up with metaphysical notions and kind of, you know, astrological charge and sympathies and all this kind of stuff. Well, eventually that supposedly gets shed. But to me, it looks like scientism never really shed the superstition and the philosophy, right? Because it's always had this grand narrative story about it. It's always had this myth that kind of underlies it. Even if you get into people like Dawkins, Hitchens, Neil deGrasse Tyson, all the sort of modern proponents of this, Lawrence Krauss, the story is still kind of the same, that we're all part of this cosmic, you know, sort of evolutionary process. And it's all gonna, you know, it's a determined thing that's going to lead to man transcending his limitations, his transcending of death, et cetera. So by about the 1920s, I know I'm jumping around, but as we come up into the 1920s, there was a movement called the Technocrats. It was kind of a fringe movement. And I think some of it's like Elon Musk's grandfather or something like that was involved in this movement back then. And then kind of didn't gain a lot of traction, but I think the advances in technology kind of reinvigorated it. People thought, oh yes, maybe we can create this sort of rational republic that's based around technocracy, that we can have computers running everything. So by the 50s and 60s, you had a lot of these elites, a lot of the social engineers, a lot of the planners beginning to say, yes, we can create this. Of course, Brzezinski's book famously says it, Between Two Ages. I was just looking back at that the other day when we did that report on the InfoWars. I had forgotten that he says that we'll have Skynet computers running everything. Like that's within the first 20 pages, he says that, yeah. And then, of course, Quigley says it in his middle chapter in Tragedy and Hope. He says, yes, in the near future, you'll have computers running cities and running everything. So that's the idea, is that technology is the key. It holds the secrets of nature. Not everybody in those, you know, working in tech or engineering and thing, they don't all have these sort of esoteric views, but a lot of them have had esoteric views. Newton was a big time proponent of alchemy.
Yeah.
The father of rocketry, what's his name?
Goddard.
The other guy, the father of the jet propulsion. He was a Crowleyan. What's his name?
The former Nazi.
Jack Parsons. Jack Parsons was a big Crowleyan, the JPL laboratory. So in other words, many people have been influenced by these sort of occult philosophies. And I know people wouldn't, I'll shut up after this, but I know people wouldn't think about it. But, you know, when Dawkins comes out and says that he has no problem with pantheism and he has no problem with aliens, I mean, he's essentially admitting this point, right? I mean, he may not actually believe those things, but what I'm getting at is just that, you know, the line between science and metaphysics is actually a pretty, there's not a clear demarcation when these people actually start talking.
No, I mean, one thing I'm struck by is your comment that they believe that the earth, and that in a way, all of existence by nature is somehow evil, and that we're somehow imprisoned by that, and that we need to break out of that somehow by creating this new consciousness, this new Superman. It's a very antinomian view. It's also Gnostic in nature.
Absolutely.
In Judaism, it sort of, you know, wormed its way into the fabric through the false messiahship of Shabtai Zvi. That's a whole big subject. But the thing is that it is completely contrary to the Judeo-Christian view, which was emanated from Sinai, which is that the Lord God created a world order, if you will, a logos is what the Greeks called it, and with Christianity made into a faith, very brilliantly. I mean, they took this sort of amoral idea, and that basically we are here to understand the nature of the world, not change it, not transcend it, but to understand it and to naturally harness its forces for the good, to improve human life, to improve our ability, you know, our function, and to know God, not to try to subvert the world and create a separate existence, a separate reality, which, by the way, is impossible. And attempts to do so have been catastrophic.
Right.
But you've made a nice kind of lineage of this, showing how this, and it's always done in secret, because if people knew what the hell was going on, they would throw it out. I mean, Satan operates in the shadows. You know, when Satan is exposed to the daylight, he's defeated. So they always operate, even hiding it from themselves, not just from everyone else. So you do have the infiltration of secret societies. And there's nothing wrong necessarily with secretness either. We all have, I mean, that's part of human nature, as long as it's for the good. But there's a vulnerability when you become secret to corruptions, and especially when you have organizations that are openly, or at least secretly, for the purpose of a corruption. And we're not just talking about crime organizations like organized crime and the mafia, which is obvious, and which also, by the way, has an interesting intersection with all of these.
Yes.
But we're talking about, like you say, the Rosicrucians, the charcoal eaters of northern Italy, and the early communist groups in Russia that were inspired by Italian communists, the Jacobin Club, which hatched the French Revolution, or at least it co-opted the French Revolution, which actually was a very pro-America revolution originally. The Weissup and the Illuminati, all of it. And I think we can say that there has been not necessarily a literal, but at least a philosophical continuation from ancient times, where you had, as you say, the big, mystery Babylon, right up till today, where you have people who are in very influential positions of wealth or influence or culture, who do tend to conduct their affairs outside of public view, and who are embracing these ideas that nature can be transcended and they can create this new kind of nature. One of their Pied Pipers, as we just mentioned earlier, was Darwin. The idea that man is not created in the image of God, but that man is nothing but an animal, a bag of bones,
Yes.
and that you therefore have a moral obligation to evolve man into a
Yes.
superior being. Now, that brings us up, as you say, to the transhumanism movement of today, which is totally infused by what you're talking about regarding technocracy and the use of modern technologies, because now they really have an enormous sense of power, because they believe that they've harnessing these technologies that can
Right.
do things like run satellites that can look at somebody's license plate and inject people possibly with chips and do these things that really will control the world and very well may end up controlling the world if we're not careful. So that's where we are.
I just remember too, there was a point I wanted to say that when we were at the beginning, when we were talking about satanic and pop culture, I forgot to mention that I went back and I was reading some of the analyses of how the CIA used pop culture in the Cold War. That's a big key to figuring that out, because the auspices were that, well, if we use modern art, if we use abstract art, if we use basically sort of, as you said, antinomian principles in art, this kind of this idea that there's not any truth, there's not any meaning, there's not any order. Art is merely emotive, right? It's all just whatever you feel, which I think is a clear departure from kind of what art is supposed to be, what it's at least always historically been in the ancient world, or in the, well, that's more nuanced, I know that, but I don't think amongst in the classic idea of what art is, that you have this rejection of order, symmetry, meaning, purpose. And I'm not trying to be some sort of weirdo that has a puritanical view of art. I think you can do different types of art that, in brings in the surreal, brings in the imaginative. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But the point is that there was a conscious decision to weaponize art in that period, whereby they began to put money into people like Jackson Pollock,
Yes,
Andy
he
Warhol.
was on the CIA payroll, wasn't
Exactly,
he?
right. And this, so they had created this thing called the Congress of Cultural Freedom. It had nothing to do with the arts. It was all just about testing out how this would affect the population in the Cold War, because it was supposed to be pitted against Soviet cosmism and realism, right? Because Soviet art had this philosophy too, where, oh, you can only do this and this and this, because it only has to reflect reality. It can't have these, imaginative or abstract things going on. Anyway, interesting, just sort of how, but what that shows is that art was immediately taken up into the psychological warfare that was going on at the time. And that's not to say that I think that Soviet philosophy is correct. I don't think it's correct. I think there was two incorrect sort of dialectical positions going on there. But what came out of that was a groundwork had been laid. And there was groundwork prior to that, of course. A lot of films, a lot of art had previously, of course, been conducted with secret state funding all the way back to the 20s and so forth. Everybody kind of did this. The Germans did it with their, when they produced the camera, they put out propaganda films. US made tons of movies that were propaganda. So it's always existed, but there seemed to be this real ramping up of using culture in the Cold War, to the extent that the CIA even went to and talked to the French deconstructionists. Just you wouldn't think there would be any. Why would they be talking to Derrida and these sort of crazy, postmodernists? But postmodernism was even sort of brought into the Cold War because they thought that anything that would be useful against the Soviets could be brought in. Anyway,
No, I mean, I think that first of all, I think it's always been a strain in art to push against, you know, reality, to be extremely abstract, right, to basically stir someone up and to be edgy. I don't have a problem with that. That's just part of the deal. Not all art, but some. The problem I have is that these ideas were harnessed by official organs and done so secretly,
exactly,
as a way to subvert. You know, maybe art itself can be subversive. I get that. I mean, right, Picasso's Guernica was very subversive in terms of showing the horrors of war and did so abstractly. But when you see it, you know what it is. And, you know, that's to me an interesting thing. It does raise consciousness. Same thing with certain symphonic works, you know, as well. The problem is that when these things are, you know, harnessed for real official questionable purposes by a more official culture, and done so secretly. Now, the issue of transhumanism, I think that it pretty much in the modern manifestation, putting aside Julian Huxley, and that, you know, he really, I think, could be seen as the father of it.
Yeah.
It really got started right here where I am in Boston, at MIT particularly. And you had Ray Kurzweil, who is still there. I think he's retired now. Brilliant scientist. Mm-hmm. In the 1990s or 1980s, he developed the talking book, which was for Stevie Wonder. You know, he read a book, you put the book in and it would read it. But he went on to found this institute that really went way off the edge, I think, in terms of trying to create a new kind of a human being that would be a combination of living and computer elements. And that this new human being would have cosmic consciousness. They would be able to recall any fact, millions of things. They would have the brain of a computer. That they would live to be 200 because they would have constant monitoring of their health and all aspects of it, and corrections and whatever was needed to be done. And in a way they would, you know, they would look perfect. You know, it kind of is like the Nazi Übermensch in many ways. And that they did view this as would be an evolved species that could eventually procreate and could actually create the next rung in Darwin's chain of evolution. And I think that has been the underlying philosophy of the transhumanist movement, of which Jeffrey Epstein was a major part here in Boston. The head professor at the media center had to resign because of his associations with Epstein. And before his resignation, on their website, he had all kinds of stuff about what exactly I'm talking about, very openly. I mean, transhumanism, it's the new future of man and it's going to cure all disease. Nothing wrong with curing disease, but the point is they were trying to use it in a way to do something that would have evolved man and that would have marginalized populations that were seen as less evolved, which has always been the darker side of this whole agenda. And Darwin, by the way, owned that.
Yeah.
He did use the term survival of the fittest in one of the later editions of his book. And he was inspired by Herbert Spencer, who was the American ambassador for Darwinism. But I know you've done some talk on that. Where are we with the transhumanist movement right now?
Well, I was looking into, I went back and I read Ghost in the Machine. Well, not the whole book, but I'd read it many years ago. And I reread the chapters that are relevant to transhumanism at the end of Ghost in the Machine that Kessler wrote. And he projected that by the time that we're living right now, we would be seeing precisely what we're seeing And he had mentions, in fact, that the government will have to do these secret programs because, of course, you know, the public's too stupid. They can't understand this stuff. So the government will have to secretly put drugs in the water and in the food, even to the extent that he says the culture will have to be degenerated, will have to manipulate and do things backdoor through medicine. And I'm not trying to be tinfoil hatter. I mean, no, I know there's nothing wrong with medicine. I just went to the clinic the other day. I'm not a Luddite. I think there's nothing wrong with modern medicine. But the point is that when you've got, you know, these groups that specifically say, you know, Fritjof Capra is another one of these global elites who wrote a book, Turning Point, and he said, we'll use medicine to bring a lot of this in. Jacques Attali said, we'll bring this in through medicine. So a lot of these guys have said the medical arena will be one of the key ways to bring in a lot of the experimentation. But where exactly we are with transhumanism is a difficult question, because a lot of that, as many know, a lot of that tech is secret. So I don't know exactly how far they've gotten with some of it. I have read like Annie Jacobson's History of DARPA book, and she kind of outlines a lot of where that might be going. I listened to a talk that was the other day about where they might be going with nanotech and where they might be going with Internet of Things. And of course, the last, probably the most relevant, is the last third of Klaus Schwab's book deals with this, where he says, we're going to have to put smart dust everywhere. There'll be an Internet of Things. Everything will be tracked and traced. Basically, it looks like a mimicking, right? Everything that we think about, well, God's omniscient, God is all powerful. He, you know, the attributes that we think of God having, they kind of try to put those into tech, right? So the all-seeing eye for them becomes the 24/7 surveillance, right? The tracking, the tracing, the satellites sort of coordinating with the nanotech and the sensors and the RFID and the Internet of Things and all that. He says it will require the later generations of tech to be put in terms of wireless. I don't want to say the wrong terms on YouTube, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
He says all of that will be necessary to bring us to the position where we can then move post-human. So I think where we are right now is that key, what they call the transition phase, where we're transitioning out of the older civilizations. They talk about like a type 1 civilization, a type 2. So they really believe that we're going to go into this next type of civilization. It'll be like the Industrial Revolution was, but even crazier, right? Because this is it's not just the transformation of economy or social order. From their perspective, it's the rewrite of biology itself. It's the synthetic rewrite of everything. And they think that will cure and fix the problem, because nature's broken, and thus silicon and these sort of tech versions of nature will be the solution. We'll move post-human, and that's just the determined necessary next phase of quote evolution.
And they're going to fail, because human nature won't allow it in the long run. They may have their victories. They'll have their Holocaust. They'll have their wars. They'll have their depressions. They'll have their, you know, chips, whatever it is. I mean, 60 Minutes just did a piece where they actually had, they talked about DARPA, and they had a scientist.
Yes, I saw that. Yep.
Yeah, right at the Pentagon, Halpern his name, who held up a chip and said, oh, we're working on this. We're going to have this ready. It's going to be done very soon. So, you know, people like me, who they say are conspiracy theorists with tin hats, who have been talking about this for a long time, now it's been vindicated. I mean, this isn't a secret anymore. 60 Minutes, you can't get more establishment than that. So it is happening. In a sense, even your smartphone, which is a wonderful instrument, I see you're looking at it right now.
I was actually looking for a text. I'm looking in scripture that I was going to mention to you. I know it's not in your canon, but
not at all.
I think it's in Third Maccabees.
Yeah,
there's a story where I think it's either in Second Maccabees or Third Maccabees, but Third Maccabees is Ptolemy.
Yeah,
and he tries to mark everybody with a tattoo, and they can't buy or sell, right? When he's oppressing the Jews, and they can't buy or sell unless they have this tattoo. And I've just I'd forgotten that that's a kind of a type of the type of thing that, you know, in the Christian scriptures and the apocalypse, John mentions Nero. I think he's talking about Nero. Nero tried to do a similar thing where he would mark people in the Roman Empire with a sort of a tattoo, and you couldn't buy yourself unless you had this tattoo that signified that you worshiped the emperor.
It had everything to do with the Maccabean revolt.
Yes.
I mean, among other things. I mean, they were putting you know, statues of Zeus in the temple, and they athletics and all of it. It was a rejection of the entire Greek thing. And it was a civil war between two Jewish factions, not only a war against the Syrian Greeks.
But the compromisers.
That's right. And the fact that they won that war is actually a victory for all of humanity, because it was a victory for sovereignty against a New World Order type empire who was oppressing people. I think that this also occurs to me. I mean, just out of the blue, the American Revolution, the Stamp Act, right? You had to have a stamp put on every every purchase, every transaction.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
Right. I mean, this isn't new. We have this probably has popped up in cultures and in situations throughout history, right up till today. That you have to, in a way, have the indicia of the state in order to function. You know, this is, you know, now we have, you know, vaccine passports. I don't want to go too far into that subject because I'll get banned on YouTube. But, you know, these are all things that fall in line with this idea that if you do, you know, Communist China, I don't think it's a secret that they have social scores for people and businesses. If you don't have a good enough social score in China, you can't get food. You know, you can't go out of your community. You can't get any rights. And I heard it mentioned here in Boston by Jeff Cooner, who is a big talk show host here, not some, you know, fringe show here, WRKO, 50,000 watt station, that he's heard that this whole business of Delta Airlines and Coca-Cola boycotting Georgia for passing election laws, the legislature, it has to do with the fact that this idea of a social score is now here, and that Google and Facebook and all the big players, they're giving companies social scores, and they divide it up into three areas. It's E, what is it? It's E, J, and G. E is for the environment. S is for social justice or socialism. And G is for governance. And they have to have a high enough score in all of these areas in order to get all of the benefits of being online and of being, you know, getting all of the who knows what. And if they don't add up to that, then they're off of the social list. And the idea of lying about the state of Georgia regulating their own elections is high on the list of S's. You know, it's like, you know, E is supporting global warming.
Oh, wow.
You know, we can look at any number of categories. It's all part of this reset, part of the Marxist agenda. So, you know, this is what's happening now with the control by the international elites. And it, you know, I think it was George Gilder predicted this, a very well-respected intellectual who spent several years in China, I think it was part of the Bush administration. I remember hearing him do an interview a couple of years ago, I think it was on NPR, where he said, China is giving social scores, and that is coming to the United States.
Wow.
And at the time, I'm like, oh, that could never happen here. I mean, we're Americans. We wouldn't tolerate that.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you know, think about this past year and tell me what we tolerate.
Yeah, I mean, it makes you realize that when you have a so-called crisis situation, as a lot of analysts have said, you can get a lot more social engineering done a lot faster. Yeah. Right? Because the crisis provides the sort of, you know, justification for all the overreaching measures, the violation of constitutional law, all that kind of stuff can just be bypassed because, oh, well, but it's a crisis, but it's a crisis. And it's the same modus operandi of the scientism crowd with ends justify the means, right? Alfred Kinsey, you know, doing the horrible things he did. Oh, well, it's okay because it's for science and it's for the greater good, right? Down the road to the greater good. So these become Pandora box, you know, opening Pandora's box justifications that then destroy all ethics. You can't have ethics at all if everything can just be justified by, well, you know, down the road, you know, it's for the good. So it's just, it's sad. It's self-destructive. And I agree. I think that the plan that the thing they're trying to bring in is so fundamentally unnatural and against, as you said, human nature. And even the fact that things have natures, right? I mean, one thing that the medieval philosophers, whether it's Aquinas or whether it's the medieval Orthodox Christian philosophers, or whether it's even somebody like Maimonides, everybody agreed in that worldview and that paradigm that things had natures, okay? And that God or the first cause or wherever things came from, they had the natures they had because they were given that nature, right? And then the modern world, after, you know, Darwin especially, that doesn't exist anymore, right? There's not a human nature that retains its identity or what it is, its substance, you could say. Over time, it can turn into anything, because from that perspective, nothing has a nature. Calling something a nature or having a nature, dog nature, cat nature, human nature, whatever, divine nature, all of those things are just human social constructs. They're just terms that we make up to describe matter in motion. And if everything is just fundamentally matter in motion, then man is just a bunch of bag of molecules. He's no different than the mailbox, right? He's just a different configuration of the molecules. So that being the case, there's nothing wrong with mutating man or mutating nature, because there is no natures are just social constructs. And literally, when you have debates with atheists, when you talk, they'll all say this. They say, yeah, there's no such thing as things don't have natures. That's an ancient medieval idea.
It's a myth. I mean, in a way, I mean, a modern expositor of that was none other than Karl Marx, who, by the way, was very much an admirer of Darwin and who wanted to dedicate Das Kapital.
Dedicate his book,
And Darwin refused because he said, I'm not an economist. But, you know, he transposed the biological theory to a social theory. And basically he said, everything is manufactured, religion's manufactured, and it's all part of the central conspiracy theory of the left, which remains that somehow the haves, the people that are in power, have created these realities as a way to exploit people who have not. And that everything essentially, when you strip it away, it is a very nihilistic view that everything is, nothing really actually even exists. Everything is manufactured and is created by energies that are seeking power, and that there is no objective existence. There's certainly no God. There is no creation. Everything is perpetual. There is no moment by which God created the universe. The universe was always here, always will be here. It's a, I think there are some elements of that. I mean, there definitely are elements of that in the New Age movement, but there's also a bit of that in the Eastern religions, that everything is, there is no moment of beginning. Everything is perpetual. And that in that paradigm, there is no objective moral and ethical code. Everything is whatever you say it is.
All is flux.
All is flux. And when you have that and you no longer believe in anything that's substantial, you're vulnerable to the siren song of these elites who then step into that void and say, we have the answer. We are, you know, that's where you get the hero worship. That's where you get Hitler. You know, we have come in. We're going to, because there is no such thing as truths, we're going to define truths because we, you know, are smarter than you, basically.
Yeah, look at these big buildings we build, right? See, I built a giant pyramid. There's a big, statue with a lion body with my face on it. Don't you understand how powerful we are, right? Look, we build ICBMs, so trust us. So we'll take care of you and we'll fix you. That's the other thing, too, is that, you know, the people who predominate in the deep state, in the military-industrial complex, all that whole apparatus, MIT, wherever you want to talk about it, like they have a very Malthusian attitude. And so knowing that they have that Malthusian attitude, to then turn around and believe the narrative that, oh, they're doing this to help humanity. You know, this is the sort of mainstream sort of normie idea that people believe. Oh, well, you know, DARPA is going to develop this, chip so that I can get the internet stuck in my head so that, you know, I can like know every answer to every question. And it's not for you, right? So anything that is, in other words, I'm saying anything that's a positive development is not for the masses. Anything that is a tracking, tracing, control experiment type of thing, that is for the masses. So if there is a positive development, it's not typically, you know, made available unless you're, you know, you've got millions of dollars, billions of dollars, something like that. It's unfortunately being used for slavery. And again, so I wasn't trying, I wanted to be clear that, I know the first and second Maccabees is about the revolt against, the Greeks, and it's Alexander's, it's Antiochus Epiphanes, who's a descendant of Alexander, who then comes in and he defiles the temple.
Yeah.
But there's another story that is third Maccabees, which is the Egyptian ruler Ptolemy. And Ptolemy tries to do the same thing. He tries to, the only reason I mentioned all that was just that when he comes in, he tries to forbid the temple, and he's forbidden from walking into the temple. He tries to forbid people from worshiping. And then, he wants to enact this tattoo. That's just what I thought was so crazy, is that I'd never even, and I know it's not a typically a canonical book, but it's it's just an interesting story that you've got these rulers who want to bypass laws. They want to make laws. They want to say that they are law, their God, mm-hmm. right? Essentially what right. they're doing is the ruler saying he's God. And then he offers a false salvation that he's the savior. He's the, and you see Nero does the exact same thing. He says, basically he's so, the savior.
The Antichrist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, and I think that for some reason, Judaism did not codify that book, but Catholicism did. I'm not sure why, but either way, it's an important.
Well, there's the old joke that, that Jews celebrate Hanukkah, but they don't have Maccabees in the canon. And then the Orthodox don't celebrate Hanukkah, but they have Maccabees in Maccabees. The canon.
It's like, right. No, I mean, who knows why those decisions were made, but I think that the Tanakh, what we call the Tanakh, was pretty much canonized in Persian times, I believe, or, you know, before the Maccabean revolt. But that's a big history right there. Jay, you've been doing so, I mean, and I admire the fact that you're doing this research, because it's pretty ugly research. And it's not the kind of thing that one wants to kind of waltz through lightly.
Especially the serial killers. I've been looking at the serial
killers. That's what I was about to bring up.
That stuff's really dark, but yeah.
And, I mean, years ago, I interviewed the author of a book about the Son of Sam, who, and I forget his name now, but it was excellent. And he actually went and visited him in prison and interviewed him. And
oh, was it Maury Terry?
Possibly. He, you know, he was part of a satanic cult and said so, right. And that he said that those same cultists are out there now, yep. And they're still doing it. And you can see their tattoo, if you will, by various forms of graffiti that show up in cities. Mm-hmm. They're involved with a lot of ritual murders around the country still.
Right.
And that I know here in Boston a few years ago, we had the case where these young guys went missing. It was, you know, and they'd be at a bar late at night, you know, they might be a little drunk and they go out, and all of a sudden they went missing. Then their bodies would be found floating in the Charles River. There was almost a dozen of those.
Was that the smiley face?
Yes, I believe.
Yes, I remember that. Okay.
And it wasn't, they weren't even like sexually assaulted or robbed. They were just right. murdered and nobody knows why.
Hmm.
That seems to me to be possibly part of that. I don't know if anyone's done that kind of deep research, but the thing is that, this is something that you have connected to most, if not all, of these mass murder cases, whether it be John Wayne Gacy or Bundy or any of the other ones. So talk a little bit about that.
Basically, in it looks like the media didn't cover or suppressed or ignored a lot of important details in many of the serial killer cases. And so I think the crux is that the so-called profile that the mainstream has is not actually correct, or the Hollywood idea of what the FBI profile of the the so-called serial killer is not accurate. In fact, many of the cases, there seems to be accomplices. We know that for a fact. In for example, in the case of Henry Lee Lucas, everybody knows he had the accomplice of Otis Toole. In the case of Leonard Lake, we know he had the accomplice Charles Ng. And then Gacy had said for a long, long time that he had accomplices. He couldn't bury all those people, that there was other people involved. And in fact, that's now come to light. Which we know for a fact that he did have an accomplice named Paskey, and Paskey directly worked with a guy named John David Norman, who was the biggest PRON producer of young boys in the 70s. And so he had distributed this vast network, and his right-hand man was Paskey. And that Gacy had said that for a long time. And then WGN in Chicago just did a whole report on this pretty recently, the local news saying, yes, we have determined that he did have accomplices. The Clown and Candyman podcast that's come out, that's pretty popular, has covered this. And this is relevant because it doesn't just connect Gacy to John David Norman, but it connects them both to the North Fox Island case, which was a Epstein style operation that was being run on an island up there in Michigan in the 70s. That connects high level people at GM. There was a GM executive who was in part of a satanic cult that was visiting these types of meetups, you could say. I don't know what else to call it, but basically we're just learning that it's a bigger network of this stuff. It's a lot more widespread than we thought, and that it's the model of the Epstein style compromise operation, which I think we've seen with I think Saville was connected to this kind of stuff. It turns out Saville was buddies with three serial killers, Myra Hindley, Ian Bradley, and the Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper. One of the bodies was found in Saville's yard. So it's turning out that Saville was a particularly nasty character, and the model again is the same of a compromised operation. We've seen that in the Franklin cover up. We see it in there was a MI5 had a compromise house that they were filming all of the underage prostitution with the MPs and the high level elites. That was a big thing going on in the UK that was connected to the Saville circles. Ed Heath, Cyril Smith, all these kind of satanic MPs in the British government being involved in this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, long story short, is that what we actually see in the case of the serial killers? I've got a list of 22 right now that show that that many of these so-called serial killers were actually connected to satanic groups. They had accomplices. They had the tendency to film it, which could suggest that either they were trying to prove that if it was a contract killing, I think some of these were contract killing. They were proving that they had done the job, right? Like take the photo and then you show that you've done it. Mm-hmm. Or they were selling the filming for, sort of in the Picton pig farm case in Canada. A lot of these guys end up well-connected, very like they just happen to have on their Rolodex or in their index cards, high-level people, high-level government officials. John Wayne Gacy is pictured with Rosalynn Carter. He's the Democratic Party precinct guy in his area of Chicago. He happens to live like a block away from Hillary Clinton. I mean, just all these weird connections with many of them. Ted Bundy, he's connected to high-level people. People have even turned up possible connections to MKUltra with Ted Bundy. It's not definite, but he is living for 1 year with a guy who was under State Department cover. I read this is all in the declassified files, by the way. This is not speculation.
Right.
He broke into Representative Jim McDermott's office to steal files. Nobody knows what files he was stealing, but they relate to psychology. And Representative McDermott is a Democrat who is on the Intelligence Committee, and he definitely has some connections to it. So it's entirely possible that when Ted broke into his office to steal stuff, it could relate to MKUltra, but that's speculation. Then lastly, many of them tend to have a background of military training, possibly even military programs of creating assassins. We know that does exist. Thomas Nerut of the Navy has come out and talked about that. And so many of them have thus trauma or DID in their background, which makes them kind of a candidate for being this kind of a person. So I know I'm rambling, but Son of Sam, I'll just list these.
Yeah.
These are all the ones that have a definitive occult or satanic type of connection that you can confirm. Son of Sam, Zodiac, Dom. And again, I'm not speculating as to exactly what went down in every one of these cases. I don't know, but this is an overlooked thing, right? Mm-hmm. Dahmer, he had an altar, a satanic altar. He was going to build our altar. There are claims and instances of that suggest satanic stuff regarding Bundy, blood drained, other serial killers that he supposedly interacted with, claim that Bundy was into this stuff. Obviously, Manson, everybody knows about Manson and the process, Church of Scientology. Henry Lee Lucas talked about the Hand of Death cult, which connected to the Matamoros cult, which is all verified. Richard Ramirez, everybody knows about him and the Church of Satan. BTK claims to have been possessed by a demon called Batter and another demon called Factor X. He also seems to encode a lot of astrological symbolism in his artwork. Mm-hmm. David Parker Ray, Toy Box Killer, he ran a small satanic cult. Herb Baumeister, around the victims, there were instances where pentagrams and inverted crosses were found. In the case of the Ripper crew out of Chicago, they were confirmed to be a small satanic sect. Everybody knows about the Dutroux affair. I dug up Irish Times articles from 20 years ago that there were actually satanic connections to Dutroux. I'd never seen that before. Monster of Florence, Pierre Pacciani was a satanic cult. Armin Meiweiss, the German cannibal killer who advertised, he was initiated into Satanism according to his profile. Israel Keyes, a recent serial killer, went into the military, came out, and committed, I think, 12, 13 murders, dedicated them all to Satan. And he wrote the letters in the blood of the victims. Like he would draw a pentagram and say dedicated to Satan, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. There's a foreign guy out of, I think, Singapore, Adrian Lim. He dedicated all of his murders to Shiva. Sean Seller is another killer who did it. North Fox Island case. Sutcliffe connected to Myra Hindley, who was a witch. Order of the Solar Temple was influenced by Crowley. They did a mass suicide.
He seems to be the grand leader, the patriarch, Crowley and the OTO. And you've done some work on their very open influence in the 60s counterculture. And I think that Jimmy Page actually lives in Crowley's house. I think
Bolas Geen. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And not to criticize his musicianship, but just, there's a lot of imagery in The Song Remains the Same, and a lot of Zeppelin stuff, and a lot of other people that we could talk about. But, Crowley seems to have been the progenitor of a lot of these people.
Yeah, Crowley, a lot of people don't know either that he was a British intelligence asset. So in World War I, he was involved with Dr. Richard Spence, who publishes at My Publisher. He has a really good book on Crowley that I interviewed him a few years ago, Secret Agent 666. And I didn't even realize that. I mean, I'd heard that he was a British intelligence asset, and then I didn't realize that he had done like provocateuring around the time of World War I and this kind of stuff. But yeah, there's a fascinating history with him. And then of course he's involved in British intelligence using him to try to lure, who's the Nazi guy? What's his name? The one that he lures to fly into Scotland.
What is Zane? Oh no, yeah. Hess.
There was part of Crowley's mystique being involved in that operation to lure Hess to come to Scotland. But yeah, I think and then he has a really fascinating speculation too, that the Crowley's drug diaries might've been a nascent form of MK Ultra. I think that's very plausible, but it looks like he's a key figure because my theory is that what Crowley's thing is that it's a way to go. It's like a grad school for creating your own cult. And it's useful for not just people who want to create a literal cult, but for even people who are pop stars. Because if you look at the pop stars who get into Crowley, like Jay-Z, Beyonce, they're utilizing it to learn a method of projecting themselves and becoming stars. And that's what Crowley's whole thing is. We're all stars, right? And whether they actually believe in the satanic philosophy that Crowley put out, I don't know, or whether it's just like a marketing technique. I mean, I'm not trying to downplay the evil of it, but I think that the reason, the pattern that you see is that with so many people that go up the ranks of his cult, when they finish, when they come out, they all go and start their own cults. Yeah, so it's a grad school in creating your own cult.
they certainly might have used some of the techniques. I mean, I don't think it's a secret that many world leaders today, including apparently Bill Clinton and others, modeled a lot of their mannerisms and their speech patterns on Hitler. You know, they studied his videos, and they like, this is how you do it. This is how you gesticulate, because they're trying to be hypnotic and talk about cult There's a whole school of thought on that. There's also possibly, and we're not going to mention it on YouTube, but an intimate connection between Crowley and the Bushes. You might have heard about that. But bringing things up to now, you have this kind of modern satanic movement and ideas and literal satanic practices that are now, as we started, out in the open. It is no longer something where they put images into a Disney movie or something where people who are in the know might see it, and that somebody else who sees it doesn't know what they're looking at, and it doesn't, I don't think it has any effect on you if you don't know what it is. You have to imbibe something into it to have some kind of a real effect. Otherwise, it's just a design. But these are symbols. And, you know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, and let's be careful, is the business of QAnon and their speculation about the, let's just say, the pizza restaurant. I don't want to talk about this here, but other things related to Jeffrey Epstein and some of his interface, which is known with the CIA and with the FBI, certainly, and possibly with other international intelligence agencies like the Mossad and the MI5. And you mentioned the Franklin cover-up. I interviewed the author on that years ago. That was a national thing that tended to involve Republican politicians, which whom we're not going to name. I guess that you have to be so careful, you know. But, you know, what is the present state of this infrastructure that, and I'm not an endorser of QAnon. I have no idea because I don't like the fact that we don't know who's behind that. And they may be into disinformation. But nevertheless, their basic thesis, which is that you have an international ring of pedophiles and that are enslaving children and that are engaging in satanic ritual. I think there's probably at least some plausibility to that. What do you have on that? And let's be very careful again.
This is right. Just in simple summation overall, my take would be that, just in my opinion, it bears all the signs of a counterintelligence type operation. So I think that anything like that, you are going to include real stuff. And in fact, the fact that it's including that stuff, which we can confirm and know is real from court cases, from real instances, you know, that's the hook that baits people. And then what they do is they'll take it, and then down the road, they'll steer you down into something kooky or something outlandish. And then human nature, human psychology doesn't want to admit that it was wrong. And people who do, you know, psychological warfare know that. They know that, you know, once you've got somebody baited on the hook, they're going to keep doubling down and doubling down. And so it was able to be used in a very effective way to take, again, real, you got to feed real stuff, then mix it with kookier and kookier stuff to where it just turns into just totally outlandish stuff. So I think it was a very successful counterintelligence operation. And I likened it to Nasara, which was a similar type of operation that was done in the 2000s around the time of like Ron Paul and that kind of stuff. And that was, it was like the Q version of newsletter. It was like newsletters before the internet and 4chan. This was the newsletter version of this. And there's all the white hats in the government, and they're going to, at any moment, that goofy new age woman was saying that at any moment, they're going to come out and there will no longer be taxes. The IRS is not going to make you pay taxes anymore. And it was all just obvious BS, right? And I think that you've been in this type of analysis way longer than me. You've done a lot of media analysis for many years longer than me. So I think you probably have a good kind of innate intuitive sense when things are suspicious or dubious. So I see it as kind of a limited hangout that was very successful in what it was attempting to do. And there've been many limited hangouts like this, where they sort of, you have a leak engine or something like this, that's very popular for a few months or even a year. Mm-hmm. And most of the time those things kind of expire, that they have an expiration date.
Right.
We had a version of this too. I don't personally think WikiLeaks was bad. I'm not saying that they're a bad entity, but it's a similar thing where it's like a, you know, public leak engine. And it could be used just like Anonymous. Remember Anonymous back in the late 2000s, it was doing the same thing. And it's a cutout. It could be used. Anybody could come on there and say, I'm anonymous. Anybody could say they're Q or whatever.
That's right. You can't trust them.
Yeah.
And you have to take a very jaundiced eye to it, which is why I don't really trust QAnon. However, there are things they brought up in the very broad sense.
Correct.
Ought to be investigated. And if you take a look at those who are attacking QAnon, that speaks volumes in terms of possibly covering up some real things. Anyway, Jay, so, you know, I really, as always, I want to thank you for joining me. It's very interesting talk. Please let my viewers and listeners know where they can get more information about you and your books.
Yeah, I have two books on Hollywood and symbolism in film. You could get those at Jay's Analysis in the shop, and then YouTube channel, all the standard social media stuff. And then I do lectures, talks, interviews, podcasts that are partly public and partly for subscription. And then, yeah, that's all I can think of. I host the fourth hour of the ALEX show.
Right. We know
About once every 2 weeks.
They're doing a great job, by the way. But you have to go, you can't get it on YouTube. You can go to TikTok and see some of their filming along the southern border. Let's just put it that way. Anyway, Jay, listen, as always, I want to thank you for joining me. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you, Charles. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care. You too.